Our guest on The Year That Made Me today was the Premier of Western Australia from 2008 until 2017. Colin Barnett describes himself as an accidental politician, but he nevertheless went on to have a long and successful career in state politics. He led Western Australia through a period of massive growth, the mining boom, infrastructure growth, and lots of change. And Colin has told his story and the story of his state in the new book, Out West, Big State, Small Town. Colin Barnett, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Yes, hello, Julian, and hello to the Sunday Extra audience.
It's great to be speaking with you. Now, I must admit, I did chuckle reading your book when you said at one point, oh, I know at this point this book might be starting to sound like an autobiography, but that is not my primary intent. So first things first, Colin, what is the primary intent of Out West?
Well, I think it was a significant time during my political career. And you mentioned some of the things, but particularly the engagement with Asia and China were important steps. And I felt that elsewhere in Australia, there probably wasn't very much awareness of Western Australia. Most people wouldn't have come to the state. That was important. So I thought I'd just put it down there. It features me and it's my story in a way. It's not a biography and it's not an accurate history either. It's just talking about the major events, what worked, what didn't, and setting out a story about Western Australia in the post-war period.
It certainly got some fascinating details about the history of Western Australia. I didn't realise, for example, that Woodrow Wilson visited Western Australia back in the day.
Yeah, that was the state's first boom when gold was discovered around Kalgoorlie, and the settler population was only about 40,000 people in 1890. At least it grew to about 200,000 within a decade. That was the first time that Western Australia actually mattered, and it also coincided with Federation and the Trans-Australian Rail Line, so it actually politically and economically started to connect Western Australia with the rest of the country.
Well, Colin, I don't want to disturb you, but the primary intent of this interview is, in fact, a biography, so let's talk about you a little bit. You were a member of the post-war baby boom generation, and you write that the Second World War loomed very strongly in your childhood because of your parents' experience. Could you tell us a bit about your parents and the family that you grew up in?
Yeah, look, I was born in the 1950s, in fact, 1950. The war was very recent, and even at a very young age, I listened to my father and my uncle talking about it. My father was one of the rats at Tobruk. He didn't say much about the experience. My uncle, to whom I was also very close, was captured at the fall of Singapore and a survivor of the Burma Railway. And what was going on in Western Australia in particular was, in that post-war sort of decade, sort of the 50s and into the 60s, was the discussion going on about Western Australia supplying iron ore to Japan, going through a reconstruction after the war. And for my parents' generation, that was a very controversial thing at the time. And I distinctly remember their conversations. And my mother, she wouldn't buy anything made in Japan. And while people look at the Pilbara region of Australia, which is one of the most important economic areas, and great engineering projects in the Pilbara where there was virtually nothing before, and then iron ore, then other minerals, and then the gas period, what has been overlooked, in my view, is an extraordinary period not only of that engineering advancement, but also to negotiate and convince a wartime generation that an engagement with Japan was our future.
Growing up, Colin, it seems like you're a pretty mild-mannered chap, although I was surprised to read that you were fingerprinted during the hunt for West Australia's first serial killer.
Yeah, in the 1960s, a guy called Eric Edgar Cook, and he was the last person executed, ultimately, in Western Australia. It was a sort of a loss of innocence. Western Australia was a big country town in reality, and suddenly we had three or four murders, possibly more, and a huge police operation, including every male, 12 years or more, was fingerprinted. It was sort of a strange sensation. I mean, tragic cases, but also there was a little bit of, you know, well, we're big guys now, we've got murderers and things.
Good to know that you weren't specifically a person of interest, though.
No, everyone was fingerprinted above 12 or older.
You started off studying at the University of Western Australia in geology. Why did you start in geology?
Well, it was all the go. Through school, you had these huge developments and rail lines and ports being built. Mm. So geology appealed to me, and I'd done quite well in high school exams in science. But when I went there, I realised science wasn't for me, so I swapped over into economics, which I enjoyed and did better.
And it was while you were at university that you actually got the call up for military service. Could you tell us about that, particularly in the context of your father's history of service, as you've told us about?
Well, that was when the conscription was in place and it was a ballot system centred around dates of birth. So you could ring up the local radio station and they'd say, oh, yes, you're in, you're in. I wasn't too happy about that. It wasn't part of my plan to have a career in the army. And however, for people like me at university, it was deferred, but I did have the medical and I did have a notice as to when I was to report. But there was an election change and Gough Whitlam was elected and immediately abolished conscription. So it was the only time my mother ever voted for the Labor Party.
There you go. Interesting. On the year that made me, we are speaking with the former Premier of Western Australia, Colin Barnett. And Colin, I hope you'll forgive me for not asking any questions about your master's thesis, which was titled A Hedonic Price Model of Consumer Demand for Urban Residential Land. We might move on from that, but straight out of university, you went to Canberra and did a cadetship with the Australian Bureau of Statistics. How did you find Canberra and what work were you doing for the ABS?
Well, that was my first real job, if you like, and I enjoyed Canberra, beautiful place, and the work was interesting. I was involved in national labour statistic collection, household expenditure survey and the poverty inquiry.
And I believe you also did a bit of work on the national anthem, is that right?
Yeah, that was quite funny. That was the decision that was being made by, I presume, Gough Whitlam, that we would adopt an Australian national anthem and there would be a survey to gauge public opinion. So that wasn't that complicated from a statistical point of view, but the major concern was to make sure that Waltzing Matilda didn't come out as our national anthem. It was thought in high places that having a song about a thief of sheep wasn't really a good look for Australia. So it was kind of fudged a bit.
You came back to Perth in the mid-80s, and it's in this period, Colin, that you've chosen the year you've nominated as the year that made you. What year have you chosen and why?
1985. In the 80s, I'd sort of moved on to be an industry economist. I moved on and I became the CEO of the West Australian Chamber of Commerce. That was where it changed because I became much more of a public figure. And two factors that really set out my future career, there were a lot of senior business people on the board of the Chamber of Commerce, and many of them were approaching retirement or recently retired, and they spent a lot of time with me. They just came into my office at various times and would sit down and talk about their career and what worked and what didn't. And often wondered, you know, why did these very senior business people spend time with me? A few years later, I realised they were actually mentoring me without my knowledge. And the other factor was I was lucky enough to be invited by the US government to take part in their international visitor program. So I spent a month travelling around the United States and that really laid out for me. I had an economics background, but that was my approach and sentiment in how you develop regional economies. I learned a lot from places like Boston, San Diego and Houston.
You've also described the 1980s, which was the prelude to your career in politics, as a period of learning what not to do. Tell us about that.
Well, the 1980s in West Australia was an extraordinary decade. It started with Alan Bond and his boat Australia 2 winning the America's Cup. Mm. So it went into a party sort of mood in the state for that decade. There was a young premier who came in and developed all sorts of relationships between government and business. I warned against that in some articles I was writing, but then there was the share market crash internationally in, I think, 1987. And suddenly all these high-profile entrepreneurs like Alan Bond and Holmes Accord and others, they collapsed or their businesses collapsed. So it was an extreme birthday celebration, America's Cup, all the big projects in Perth collapsing and the like. So I talked a lot about that. And after 5 years as head of the Chamber of Commerce, I started to think, well, it's been a really exciting role and I enjoyed every moment of it, but I thought I can't keep doing this for much longer. So I started to think that maybe I should go into politics. Mm. Then all of a sudden the option came there, the opportunity.
Yes, indeed. And we will move on to that. But before we do, Colin Barnett, I've got to say there are some very unexpected cameos in your book. So I did want to ask you about one of those cameos, which is from the world-renowned American economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, and what you could loosely be described as a near-death experience. Could you tell us about that?
Because the America's Cup was to be then followed in 1987, there was a huge inflow of very prominent Americans. Walter Cronkite, the famous broadcaster, and John Kenneth Galbraith were two of them, but there were a lot more. He was really getting on at that stage, and I think he was 6'9" tall. The US consulate was obviously organising the visit, and through the Chamber of Commerce, I joined forces with the consul, and we jointly hosted his visit in various ways. You know, he was very close to John Kennedy, and I thought we've got to find a way of moving him around. We can't just whack him in a taxi and send him off. A friend of mine had a funeral service, a very well-known Perth funeral service, and I rang him up and I said, look, we've got John Kenneth Galbraith here. Can you lend me one of your limousines?
It wasn't the hearse, I'm assuming.
No, but he had a very suitable limousine, professional drivers and so on. He covered up all the signs about it being a funeral service. And for 3 days, John Kenneth Galbraith was driven around Perth in various venues. He never knew, but the American consul and I both knew. And it was kind of very funny, but it was a great visit. We were getting that sort of prominence. It was also a time when there were a lot of problems in the Middle East, a bit like today with Iraq and so on. And a lot of US naval visits were coming in. You know, the Missouri, where World War II was finally signed off, nuclear submarines and the like. And my wife and I, Lynn, we got involved in hosting some of the Americans and some of the older ones, not particularly old, but, you know, the senior officers and that. We had them around for dinner and things like that. So it was a very close relationship then with the US.
Now, Colin, you've told us that you'd been working at the Chamber of Commerce but starting to think about a career in politics. But at the same time, you only joined the Liberal Party after you decided to run for Parliament. Could you tell us about that and how your rapid enrolment was received within the Liberal Party?
I did live in the Cottesloe electorate and probably, along with Nedlands, the most prominent traditional Liberal seat. I had helped the Liberal Party in various ways, spoken at some of their policy discussions and seminars and things from an economic point of view. But suddenly the then member for Cottesloe suddenly resigned. That was a surprise. And I thought, well, this is my chance. I've got to try and grab it. A by-election was called. I wasn't a member of the Liberal Party. I joined and just qualified. I think that might have been fudged a little bit by a few people in the party to get me over the line. There was a immediate by-election run by a very loyal group of particularly women who took it over. You know, 4 weeks later, I was a member of Parliament and immediately appointed as a member of the Shadow Cabinet. And then 3 years on, I was deputy to Richard Court and deputy leader of the Liberal Party in government. So it was just, you've got to be lucky in politics, and I had luck all the way.
Yeah, well, that certainly is a lot of luck and a very rapid trajectory to senior leadership positions, which you write about in detail, your time in the Court government. In particular, you describe the construction of the Goldfield gas pipeline as your proudest moment. Why was that?
In 1993, when the Liberal Party had been elected, I did most of the policy work. I mean, I wasn't necessarily the most natural politician, I don't think, but I did the policy work for the party virtually. And one of the things that Richard Court and I announced on the eve of that 93 election was that we were going to build a pipeline from the northwest coast, the Woodside Project, right through central Western Australia down to Kalgoorlie. And we said, we're going to get the private sector to do it. People laughed at it, but by the 1996 election, it had been built by industry under a government mandate. There were 6 power stations along its route. It was classic economics, you know, making a distinction between the role of government and the role of industry, putting it together in a correct way and seeing that major piece of infrastructure and energy developed, including even offshore gas supplies. I felt like an applied economist. All the stuff I'd sort of learnt at university and so on, I got to actually apply, and there were lots of examples of that.
Colin, it was obviously a very productive and rewarding time, but you're also frank about some of the tensions within that government. And indeed, you write about the ABC's resentment towards you. And you're not actually talking about the national broadcaster there. You're talking about efforts to actually get you out of state politics at one point, including potentially by swapping roles with Julie Bishop. How did you prevail over the ABC, Colin? And tell us your route to the leadership.
Richard Court was premier, and Richard and I, you know, we had our differences, but we worked well as a team. And then lost the election in 2001, and Labor came into power. It was assumed, I think, that Richard Court probably would leave politics, and I said that I would stand for leader. That's tradition in the Liberal Party, that after an election, all positions are declared vacant, and there was an expectation that that's what would happen. However, there was a plot that was put together, really built around factional lines, and I always stayed out of factional politics. I just didn't, I wasn't interested in it, and I didn't go near it. And there was a plan to bring Julie Bishop into state parliament. And Julie and I have always got on well, so I found that quite extraordinary. I was asked about my attitude, and I said, well, I just choked on my Wheaties that morning because I knew nothing about it. And that was really Richard Court's idea of what should happen. There was a factional group that called themselves Anyone But Colin, the ABC group. The deal with Julie Bishop just collapsed, and I think Julie probably was misled, and it was a very bitter thing. But then another election was held, and I was unanimously elected as Liberal leader and opposition leader. I mean, it even got to one stage where the state council had their annual, you know, major state council for the year, and had a major function held, a ball, if you like. Lynn and I were seated at table 52 at the back of the room near the fire escape. I mean, it was quite funny. We just laughed. But so there was a lot of patching up, but gradually I was able to bring the party back together, at least the parliamentary side. But I made a decision when I came into parliament that there would be a bit of jealousy, that I was an outsider. I was the member for probably the most valuable high-profile electorate of Cottesloe. So I just decided there'll be a lot of nonsense going on. There was a history of that. And I just took a decision, if anyone wants to have a go at me, they can, but it'll be thought out and fought out maybe publicly. So No one really got very far, but they had a few goes at me. That's politics. But I didn't. I just, did what I thought was right.
So you did become opposition leader the first time, but then lost an election. So to come back from that is a pretty extraordinary thing. In 2007, Colin, you'd actually announced your intention to retire from state politics at the next election. But then less than a year later, you're thrust into the role of opposition leader. And before long after that, you're the Premier of Western Australia. Given that you had been planning to retire, what was that plan? And could you tell us how it came to be that you didn't get to implement it?
In a sense, just lucky. Things bounced my way. Going into the 2008 election, about 6 months before it was expected, the then Liberal leader, Troy Buswell, got into all sorts of trouble, poor conduct. He pulled out of the leadership. People suddenly gathered around me and said, you know, you've got to come back. You're our only chance to save the furniture, probably was on their mind. Alan Carpenter was the Labor Premier. He'd been there for about 3 years. And it was just a campaign from heaven. Everything went my way, and we won a surprise election quite comfortably. And from there on, I had 9.5 years as Premier. And as I said, everywhere I went, I was lucky. So not lucky for Troy, because I thought he was, you know, I tried to persuade him to stay on. But there I was, and I had a good run. I mean, the election, I was elected virtually the same week as the global financial crisis. So there was a big economic issue to deal with. Mm. But I did well. And then in the following election, we increased our majority. So, you know, time catches up with every prime minister and premier, and it eventually caught up with me. But I'd spent 8 years as deputy leader in government, then a further 8.5 years as premier in cabinet.
And you did lead Western Australia through a period of incredible transformation, despite things like the global financial crisis, the mining industry booming off of massive resources demand from China. And you alluded to that earlier, Colin, in particular, the importance for Australia and the Australian economy of engaging with Southeast Asia, China, Japan, and you narrate a lot of your involvement in that. Could you tell us a little bit about what you learned from those engagements and why you think that's particularly important in terms of the current political debate in Australia?
I guess the view that I and also Richard Court had was that China was the next big opportunity for Western Australia, in fact, for Australia as all, and it was iron ore, gas from Western Australia and coal from New South Wales and Queensland, but there was virtually no trade beyond that. And we had a Chinese vice premier, Zhu Rongji, came to visit Western Australia, very interested in the iron ore industry. That was what he was focused on. And I accompanied him on a trip around the Pilbara area and the iron ore projects. And I made the comment to him that, you know, would China look at buying gas in the future? He was absolutely disinterested in that. I managed to persuade the pilot of the small aircraft we were in to do a figure eight over the North West Shelf project. That evening, there was a dinner in his honour, and he got up and he talked about iron ore and various things, and he said, "We may also buy gas from you." And that was the start of the relationship with China. Richard Court led the way. I'd also heavily involved. And then by the time I became Premier with a gap, we really took it further. And during my time as Premier, iron ore production doubled and liquefied natural gas trebled during that eight-year period. And they were two of the three biggest exports from Australia. So done by a personal relationship. And while the companies put up the money and did the commercial side, we built as politicians the actual close relationship with China, which continued on. And that was a really exciting period because China was still very early stages of development and it grew rapidly. We had at one stage 85 Chinese delegations came to Western Australia. And I might add, Julian, I think the federal government, both persuasions were quite jealous of that. At some stages, China would only talk to myself and not Canberra. There was tension in that from both Labor and Liberal governments, but the relationship with Western Australia was also enshrined in agreements with their national government through the National Development Reform Commission, which oversees all of Chinese big projects inside and outside China. So it was a unique role, and I think if the federal government had been a little bit more open-minded, they would have done better.
Of the many memorable experiences that you had in China, there's a very good story in the book about one, which was a solo dance performance that you found yourself giving with Gina Rinehart. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was in the 90s in one of my earlier visits to China in Shanghai at the Peace Hotel, which is a very historic place in China. Rio Tinto also had a group there, not related to my visit, but they happened to be there, and Gina Rinehart was with them. We were in this basement place where you had to be 80 to be part of their band or group. And they actually, in a defiant way, kept on playing there right through the Japanese occupation. So very incredible. So there are a lot of young Chinese people, you know, dancing and that. And some of the guys from Alcoa persuaded that Gina and I would get on the dance floor for a moment. And reluctantly, we did so. About 30 seconds into it, all these girls started clapping and left the dance floor with Gina and I there by ourselves. So we somewhat awkwardly struggled back, but it was very funny. And they just all cheered and clapped us. So, yes.
A close relationship with the business community and the mining sector was obviously central to the success of your government, Colin. It seems these days Gina Rinehart's dancing with One Nation rather than the Liberal Party. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's going to run its course. And as I say, I pretty well stay out of day-to-day politics. But if I have any advice to the Liberal Party, I would just treat One Nation, Pauline Hanson and members with courtesy. Don't talk about doing preference deals and the like and don't attack them. Just let it run its course. You know, federal election's 2 years away and I think it will settle down.
Colin Barnett, for an unashamedly pro-business and pro-development Minister and Premier, you speak in the book about things like regulatory risk for business, but you're also perhaps surprisingly critical of some natural resources companies in terms of their dealings with government. And you describe the flip side of sovereign risk for companies as corporate risk for government. Could you speak to that a little?
Well, Hoping not to be sued by one of those companies, but it will take a risk. Look, it is true, and West Australia's got a history of entrepreneurs. Some would call them cowboys. You know, we had the share crash in the 80s. There were various roguish behaviours during the 1890s gold rush and the like. And, you know, Clive Palmer created all sorts of problems in the relationship with China and so on. So I had a very strict view of separating the role of government and the role of the business community. I was close to business and I did all sorts of things to assist them in projects and the like and infrastructure development, but I kept that separation. When Brian Bourke was Premier in the 80s, you know, he failed to do that. In fact, he went the wrong way and that led to what was called WA Inc. And I took a strict view, and probably one of the main examples would be when, with the growth of China, I had the global heads of BHP and Rio Tinto come to see me. And they said, look, you know, China's growing. We need to get more iron ore projects underway. So we want your support to give very quick approvals and the like. Now, the two big producers had concessions from their initial development of iron ore in the 1960s, which meant they paid a very much lower royalty. And I said to them, you need to understand, I am not much interested in selling you ever-increasing amounts of iron ore at half price. And I said, so that's got to be fixed. They went into the next room, came back in about 10 minutes and said, we agree. And that's been worth probably $2 billion a year to Western Australia. So I took a very strict line, you know, reminded them that they didn't own the iron ore. The state government, Western Australian government, owned it, and we weren't going to sell it cheaply. So that was accepted, and they did all the projects, and as I said, we doubled iron ore production.
Colin, looking back on your time as Premier, what was your proudest achievement and what was your biggest regret?
Well, I think the Goldfields gas pipeline was, and I think also the massive Gorgon project, that offshore LNG project that Chevron put in place, that had stalled. And I settled that with Chevron, and that's the biggest industrial project in Australia. So that's those two stand out. I think what's probably not recognised is that we also, as a government, did a lot of things. I mean, we settled native title over all Aboriginal people in the southwest, Perth in the southwest. I'm very proud of that. Something was initiated by Aboriginal people too, a lot of the Kimberley region was put into national parks. So I'm proud of all of that. A couple of things went wrong, but not too many. my regret is something that didn't happen, and not one of the biggest projects by any means, but I was very keen to see an open range zoo developed in Western Australia. And we just started the work on not building it, but the site selection and the like. The following Labor government, unfortunately, just cancelled that. And most states around Australia have got open range zoos. People don't want to see elephants and giraffes and things in enclosures. And that was a pretty modest project, but it didn't happen. And that's the disappointment that I mentioned right now to as many people. And what I find is they just all nod their head in agreement. Kids in Western Australia, it's a long way away from the East Coast. And I think they should be able to see animals in as natural an environment as we can do. And West Australia certainly had the opportunity to do that.
You write in your book about just how brutal it is for political leaders to lose an election. But it also seems that you had a bit of a sense coming into the 2017 election that your time might be up. And it turned out that it was emphatically. Could you talk about the impact of leaving office and losing power for you?
It wasn't so traumatic for me. I mean, obviously there's disappointment because you haven't done everything you would like to do or thought you could do. The loss in 2017, as I said, I had a long career, a terrific career, and pretty well everything I touched worked. You know, I was still the member for Cottesloe. What I think is the hardest thing is that many young and talented members of parliament on all sides of politics, when the tide's going out, there's very little you can do. You get washed out with the tide. And many of them would have borrowed money against their house to be a member. They're unemployed. It's very hard to get employment if you have been a member of parliament and particularly a minister. And what do? They're forgotten and they usually go out broke, despite the way the public often sees it. So it's a demanding job, but a fantastic opportunity to actually achieve things and do things.
Colin Barnett's book is called Out West, Big State, Small Town. And Colin, it's been great talking about your life and your state on The Year That Made Me. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Julian. I've enjoyed it.
And we always finish up The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us, Colin, and why?
Well, this ties in with 1985. Van Morrison, Brown Eyed Girl. That's Lynn. Fantastic. We got married at that time.
And here it is, Brown Eyed Girl. Colin Barnett, thank you once again.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.